To introduce today's guest speaker, here's Penn State's Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, Blanny Bowen.
Thanks, Betty. Good afternoon. Thank you. Homicide is the second leading cause of death among American youth, followed closely by suicide, according to the Centers for Disease Control. In 2005, more than 5,600 young people ages 10 to 24 were murdered, and more than 721,000 young people were treated in emergency rooms for injuries resulting from violence. Clementine Barfield, our speaker today, understands the personal side of these statistics. After her son was murdered in Detroit in 1986, Ms. Barfield started a program entitled Save Our Sons and Daughters. This organization is often called by its initials, So Sad. It counsels survivors of homicide victims, organized violence prevention workshops, and trained volunteers in crisis intervention techniques. So Sad also lobbied local and national public officials to focus attention on the victims of crime. Ms. Barfield has been recognized by both Presidents Reagan and Clinton for her outstanding contributions in assisting the victims of violent crime. She served on the Advisory Board of Survivors for Violence Prevention with Dr. Deborah Prothro-Stith at Harvard University. She has been a keynote speaker at various national conferences on gangs, schools, and community, the Children's Defense Fund National Conference, and the National Organization for Victims Assistance Conference. Her work also was featured in a documentary entitled Making Peace, and she also appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, the Phil Donahue Show, 2020, the McNeil-Lehrer, and the Justice Files. Ms. Barfield is a graduate of Wayne State University in Detroit. She is currently working as a writer, lecturer, consultant, and trainer. She's just written a book on something I need to read on parenting, which is now at the printers, and it's called It Starts in the Home. Ms. Barfield is a mother who moved from deep personal loss to activism and community building to prevent violence. The title of her presentation today is Beyond Mourning, The Death of My Son. Please welcome Ms. Clementine Barfield.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bowen. Good afternoon to all of you. It's a real pleasure to be able to share with you the work that I have done in the aftermath of my sons being shot, and one of my sons being shot fatally. I am the 13th of 15 children born to my parents, who were hardworking farmers in the Mississippi Delta. And four of my siblings had already passed away when I was born. My parents were the children of grandchildren, of slaves. And to them, the family meant everything. The survival of family meant everything. They preached and taught that the natural order of life is for one generation to do better than the previous one. So my mother taught us that we could do better than they had done as poor farmers in Mississippi. And of course, she had some reinforcement, some positive reinforcement from the tree outside. See, today you call that corporal punishment, but when I grew up, we called that love. But my mother had an eighth grade education because there were no high schools for poor black people in that part of Mississippi. But if you wanted to go to high school, you had to board with someone in town. So my oldest sister died while boarding with someone in town. But education was still important to my mother, and she preached that to us. So we had a legacy that we honored, because it wasn't just my mother that was preaching this. It was my grandparents and all of the elders. And they were saying, you know, you can be something in life. You know, you just have to go to school and learn. And the other thing that they taught us was that we weren't allowed to have what you call a mean spirit and be bad, because the old folks said you had to break them from that. So from early on, we were disciplined in such a way that we knew that we had to succeed. There was no option. We had to do better. We had to go to school. We had to continue this cycle of life, this natural order that they talked about. So when my sons were shot, that natural order of life was interrupted. I tried to carry on my parents' and grandparents' legacy of keeping the family close, of instilling in the children the idea that they can do better than I had done and their father had done. And then suddenly I was faced with a different kind of crisis than my parents had in burying four children that died of natural causes. Someone was angry enough or mean enough, hateful enough, evil enough to do this to my children. So my 15-year-old son was shot in the back of the head and sustained lifelong injuries, and my 16-year-old was killed. So, you know, my first thought was, what would Mama do? And I knew that my mother would go on, because she had done it time and again, just like her mother before her and her grandmother before her. So it was never a question of giving up. It was never, for me, it was never a question of keeping my grief and my pain private. I wanted everybody to know what they lost, not just what I lost, but what they lost. My son was a special kind of person. When he was little, I knew he was going to be a minister. I knew it not only because he said it, but I knew it because he embodied that type of spirit where he cared about people. Of course, he was the class clown, too. You know, he was always joking and making fun. But he was this great guy. And I wanted people to see that. I wanted people to see his face. I wanted to validate his worth. And then I started thinking about the fact that my son had gone to funeral after funeral of friends and classmates and teammates. He was an athlete. And teammates that had been killed. It's like, where was I when all of this was happening? Why didn't I really pay attention? It's as though this was happening somewhere else. You know, I didn't really connect. And suddenly, when this happened to us, I connected. And I wanted everybody to connect, because it was like, shame on us that we're burying our heads in the sand and acting as though we don't know that our kids are killing each other. How much worse can things be? If somebody else killed one of our kids, if the police killed one of our kids, that'd be outrage. If a white person killed one of our kids, there would be outrage. If a Chaldean, Detroit has the largest population of Chaldeans outside of Iraq. If a Chaldean killed one of our children, there would be an outrage. I wanted there to be an outrage when our kids kill each other. And beyond mourning the death of my son, I started planting seeds. I started planting seeds for peace because, first of all, we had to make the community aware. We had to sensitize the community. So the very first meeting that I called, 87 people came, a lot of press came, and ministers started looking at this and said, you know, this has national implications. Now, you need to go sit down so we can handle this. They said, if you sit down, we'll make you a Rosa Parks. And I said, well, first of all, I can't sit down. My child is dead. I got another one shot in the head. How am I going to sit down? I can't sit down. So they said, this was my pastor saying this. He said, you're stupid. You think you women can make a difference? See, I'd been calling together all of the other mothers of children that had been killed that year because, you know, I was constantly hearing about children being killed, but really not hearing. 43 children, 16 and younger, were shot to death that year. 365 children, 16 and younger, were shot but survived. And that's not including other ways that children may have been killed. Just the ones shot to death. And those other mothers and a few fathers and I started organizing around the city. We started going into the schools and talking to the kids about stopping violence and conflict resolution. We started having support groups. We started, for survivors of homicide victims and working with children that had been traumatized by violence and homicide. The reason we started children's support group was because the 11-year-old brother of a 15-year-old girl that had been shot and killed, his classmates and friends would tease him. Oh, your sister got killed. And it was funny to them, but I think it was funny because they didn't know what to say or what to do. So they teased him. They did what children do, whether it's in crisis or in fun. You know, they act out things in terms of play. So we started working with counseling with children by going into his classroom. And what we found in his classroom was that a majority of the kids in his classroom had somebody that had been killed. In one elementary school, we had a forum for fourth graders. And when asked how many of them had someone that had been killed, well, the majority, 85, 90% of the children raised their hands, and the principal got mad at them. She started fussing. You put your hand down. You know you don't know anyone that's been killed. And I said, let the children speak. So I just started pointing out different ones, tell us what happened. And the children got up and started reciting. You know, it was as though they were reciting a poem. They just got up and started reciting who had been killed in their families. And a lot of those children had witnessed the killing take place. And I'm very careful to say killing and to make a distinction between killing and murder because there really is a difference. And the difference is the plot. In a murder, it's like this is what the person planned to do. But in most cases in the black community and poor communities, it's not a murder. It's not a plot. It's anger. It's internal aggression that they lash out and heap onto another person. But many of these children had witnessed a killing. Father killed the mother, mother killed the father, a grandparent was killed. And this was their reality, and it's like shame on the principal for not knowing that. But we worked in the schools tirelessly, trying to give the children a sense that they were not alone, a sense that there was some hope, there was somebody that understood what they were going through, validating their feelings and their fears. And in addition to working in the schools, we started a program called Harvest. We had this program every year, but we started it because I'd gone to a radio station out in sort of, is this considered the suburbs of the country? Suburbs? Country? A community like this. And the radio station was surrounded by open fields. And I was thinking, oh, my God, we could get the kids out here and they could work the land, you know. I'm a farmer, you know. I was thinking in terms of what the children could plant and grow and sell and earn, you know. So I had this vision, but they wouldn't allow us to have the use of land because they didn't want the liability. But we found an acre of land in the city that was owned by one of the churches, and we started a harvest program for the children to plant because so many of them, their only connection to the earth was when they go to a funeral. Somebody gets killed or somebody died, they go to a funeral, and they see this dirt heat on somebody, but never really think in terms of life coming from the earth. So that was our goal, to teach them that life comes from the earth. And we had an education committee and an economic committee, and they planned workshops with the kids to teach them as they were learning. So 1 hour they're outside working in the garden, 3 hours they're inside in workshops and classes. And it got to be a very well-known program. A lot of programs around the country have duplicated this effort, but we were the first to actually start it with the urban gardening. And we used brothers and sisters of children that had been killed in the program first, and then we included other children that had committed crimes even. But the Harvest program was just one of the many programs that we did throughout the city to try to make a difference and try to sensitize people to what was going on. And even today, I run into grown-ups that were in the Harvest program. They say, oh, Ms. Barfield, I was in your Harvest program. See, we paid those kids. You know, we raised money and we paid them $40 a week. About 5 years later, somebody in my family, an uncle, I think, that's what Snoop Dogg called him. He came along and said, well, you've been paying these kids and a stipend, and you didn't pay me any taxes on these. Uncle Sam. So then, you know, we had to pay him what he said we owed him in interest and penalties and all of the above. And by that time, we were so entrenched in the community that the General Motors Foundation came through and said, we'll handle that for you because we want you to stay in this community because it matters. So I think that was the first time I really started to understand that working for peace is really making a difference, that you know, you can't measure what you're doing. It's hard to measure when you're making a difference in a child's life or in a person's life, but, you know, you can always measure the downside. You can measure body count, but prevention is so different. But it gave us the will to do more. We always did the crisis intervention programs. We, you know, support groups, and once we started getting funding, we hired counselors and trained them and then let them counsel with people. It's not as though people just knew how to work with survivors of homicide victims, because working with grief was something that in our communities had always been very private. People kept it in the closet as though it was something dirty or ugly. But we brought it out in the open, put a face on it, and, you know, taught people how to work with us and how to help us. Some were psychiatrists, counselors, and the like. And we focused on healing. And in focusing on healing, what we found in you know, working with survivors is many of them had layers because they were coming from different stations in life. Some were coming in out of the street. Some were coming in with addictions. Some were coming in from being criminals. You know, some were just, you know, hard-working blue-collar families, college professors. The deputy chief of our police department had a homicide in his family. The chief over homicide had a brother and his whole family that were wiped out. So it wasn't any as though you can look at any particular family and say, oh, this female head of household and her kids are being killed. No, no, no. It was across the board, just anybody and some of everybody, judges, school teachers. So in teaching peace, we had a lot of people to join what we call the movement, because it wasn't just about any one of our individual grief. It was about all of us collectively. And individually, we might try to heal our broken selves alone, but together, we were a force to be reckoned with. And we had chapters of So Sad in a number of cities, but our very first city to organize outside of Detroit was Philadelphia. And Philadelphia had a chapter of So Sad for 3 years. They got a lot of honors from the governor and, you know, but they soon started to, after about 3 years, they started to kind of dwindle apart. Washington, D.C., Louisville, Kentucky, Flint, Michigan, Fresno, California, maintained their chapters of So Sad for about 11 years. We worked with gangs, uniquely with gangs. And, you know, this movement to not just stop violence, but to promote peace and make peace popular and acceptable was you know, increasing around the country as we framed this whole issue. But some great young people joined us and started to work with us and like building a whole separate movement. I've always heard that in the civil rights movement that the movement itself had gotten stagnated until college students joined. And we had some great young people that joined with us. One, a young PhD candidate that started working with us, activist. He went into the prisons and taught the prisoners the peace program. About an 8-week program, he worked with a group of prisoners because we got permission from the prisons to take children into the prisons. It wasn't a scared straight program because we learned early on that we could not scare children. They are not afraid of death. What they're afraid of is life. Because in life, a lot of them have dropped out educationally, they've dropped out mentally, they've dropped out socially, and then they have to compete in life with bright young people like yourself that's pursuing an education and trying to do all the things right. Now, they're scared of that. But death, they were not afraid of death because in death, they were bigger than life. So the only thing they cared about death was dying big and having a big funeral and having people cry over them. And, you know, that made them feel like they could be somebody. And a lot of them would plan their own funerals, you know. This is who I want to sing at my funeral. and this is who I want to say something about me. You know, so it became just a popular thing to do. And it seems as though death is still a popular thing because young people are still killing one another. But this young man trained the prisoners in how to work with the students so that when the students were brought into the prisons, they talked to them about what prison was really like. They talked to them about, you know, their loss of freedom. They talked to them about not being able to have interactions with a person of the opposite sex. You know, they made it real to them. And just so that they have a similar message, he taught them what they should be saying. And when I would go to the prison, even as I would go to the where we started a chapter of So Sad in the prison, and we were taking children from the middle schools and high schools into the prison. When I walked the prison yard, oh, it was with such pride that those men would be yelling, "Mother, how are you doing?" You know, it's like they felt good about what they were doing because they felt like they were making a difference because it helped to transform them. And some of those same prisoners that, I'll just call him the guy for now, the same prison that this guy taught in peace and conflict resolution, they started another program. They started a program called Child of the Month Club, where they would put on programs in the prison. They're still doing it. I'm saying it as though it's past, and it's not. This is still a very active program in Michigan prisons. Child of the Month Club raised money. They do all kinds of programs to raise money for children that have been injured. One little boy needed a heart transplant. They raised money for him. A child was killed, was burned when a house was firebombed. They raised money for her. They raised money for children. You know, whoever So Sad decided to give the money to, that's who they raised money for. And, you know, they felt good about what they were doing. And a lot of young, educated college students and high school students started following this guy because he wasn't afraid to step into a situation and address it. And in the community, they had the utmost respect for him. And when he stood up to speak, it was with such pride that I would say, "That's my child over there," the one with the shiny bald head. "That is my godson, Dr. Earl Henderson." And Earl did some miraculous work in working with gangs in Detroit and teaching prisoners and in, I would call Earl and say, a mother called and she said, "Her kids are getting ready to go out of town to sell drugs. You need to get over there and talk to them and don't let them go." And he went and talked to them and they didn't go because, see, he would break things down to them in such a way, about how you go about cutting up drugs. And they didn't know how to do any of that. He said, "Well, you don't even know enough to be trying to leave home, trying to do something like that." So, you know, he talked him out of leaving that night. But that was the kind of emphasis that he had. Guys in the neighborhood that were trying to be legit and had legitimate businesses. One had a studio in his basement. He wanted him to come check it out. He went and checked it out and did a CD with him, because he's a prolific speaker. And he did a CD with him, you know, just giving him that kind of validation and that kind of support. And those are the kind of people that came to us to work with us. So we were never alone. We were never just survivors of homicide victims. We're young people. And Grace and Jimmy Boggs, who marched with A. Philip Randolph in the March on Washington in the 1940s, and Jimmy helped to organize the first UAW in the Ford Motor Company, and friends with Malcolm, and marched with King, and, you know, These are the people with us. Alice Jennings, that was a trial lawyer and active with the Michigan Trial Lawyers Association. And then we had all these trial lawyers working with us and helping us. So it was a movement that just kept growing, and people kept doing things. Homicide rates started to go down. Less children were being shot. Less children were being killed. And one year, a group of students from University of Michigan called to say, you know, we've started this program called Alternative Spring Break. It started out of Vanderbilt. And they came and volunteered their spring break to work with us, and we taught them our peace program, and they went into the schools to teach peace. And the next year, we got University of Michigan, Vanderbilt, and a school from Pennsylvania, and I can't think of the name of the school, but it was a small school here in Pennsylvania. The year after that, it was about 10 schools, and after that, it was like 30 schools from different four schools out of Florida, Florida State, Florida A&M, University of Miami. Out of Virginia, we had George Mason, James Madison, Virginia Tech, Pepperdine out of California, different schools from Ohio, Chicago, Northwestern University, one of the students from Northwestern. And these were schools that would come every year to work with us. They spent their spring break. Not all students go to Florida and hang out on the beaches. We're talking students that travel some up to 25 hours in a van coming to Michigan, to Detroit, to work with us, to learn our peace program and teach peace in the schools. And one student from Northwestern University went back to Northwestern and started a program similar to Alternative Spring Break for high school students, inner city high school students. Northwestern still has that program, and they're taking high school students around the country volunteering their service. University of Maine, one of their students wrote me and told me that she had gotten a position teaching high school in Israel. Students changed their majors. Students joined the Peace Corps. We planted seeds with those students, and they are doing great things around this country. There was this school from Pennsylvania. Was it Penn State? No, I think it was Pitt. University of Pittsburgh. One year, University of Pittsburgh brought all FIM students. You know, so every year they were different, but University of Pittsburgh, those students started their own chapter of Save Our Sons and Daughters, and they started going into the schools in Pittsburgh teaching peace. So we are never without hope, because beyond the murder of my son, I know that I planted some seeds in the hearts of a lot of people, especially young people. And I know that those seeds are still springing up, like wildflowers. I don't know what some of these students are doing. I got a call one year. One was in Washington, doing a fellowship, and she was working on curriculum development. And I got an award from University of Michigan, and one of the students there came to me and she said, "Miss Barfield, I'm one of yours." Now, I don't remember all of them, but she said, "I'm one of yours, and you are going to be so proud of me someday." She was already working on her master's and working on campus, and I said, "I'm already proud, because whatever it is that you learned, you didn't forget it." See, students would come from all over the country. Sometimes we have 300, sometimes 400, and you know, to work with us, and most of them, especially University of Vermont, those kids cried. It's like 1 year they would pass the word to the next group. When you go to Detroit, will you please cry? You know, it's because it just seemed as though they did that, because they cried all the time. You know, they had not been exposed to anything like that, like some of the problems that were happening in the community, and they just cried. But it made a difference. And I always told them, they said, what good can we do? And we're only going to be here 1 week. I said, but your role is twofold. First of all, you're going to work with these students. You're going to tell them about peace. You're going to help them define what peace can be in their lives. And then you're going to tell them about your experiences in school and that higher education is possible. And then on the other end, everything that you learn, that you glean from this experience, you take it with you. You take it with you back to your community, back to your school. Take it with you as you become change agents in the future, because with your college degree, you're going to be doing different kinds of work. And I want you to always remember what is happening in inner cities and what is happening with the poor so that you can make best decisions about how to help and how to make things better. So this thing called hope is not new for us. We've planted the seeds of hope. Change is not new for us, because I believe that change is going to happen in America because so many young people have been committed to peace, and mainly because we planted those seeds, and it's been the blood of our children that's paved the way for things like this to happen. Thank you. He is a dynamic brother. See, you all probably don't know that, but, you know, for young people that's exposed to him that's in his class, I guarantee you, he's teaching them something.
A number of people asked what they could do to help, and I'm going to give you a name and an email address, but what can I do to help? I don't live in an urban area, but want to make an impact. How would you answer that? Is there other people? In fact, there are three universities wondering what their departments can do as well.
There is a lot that you can do. Philadelphia is real close. And Philadelphia now has one of the highest homicide. They've always had a high homicide rate, but the problems with violence and crimes and all the things that I've talked about that's happening in Detroit are also happening in Philly. And, you know, just in some places where the economy is real bad, it's just so much worse. But what you can do as a department, I'd like to talk to you about that. Seriously, if anyone left their name with that, I'd like to talk to you about that, because I'm looking for alternative ways of dealing with the problem. I was saying to you this morning about the story of the man who says that when he saw a baby floating downstream, that he took the baby out of the water And then he saw another, and he took that one out of the water, and another. And he finally decided that he had to go upstream and figure out who's throwing the children into the water. And in trying to figure out how to deal with root causes, my understanding at this point is that we have to do some things differently. We have to institutionalize this peace thing. You know, we can't have pieces of peace floating around. We got to find some ways of pulling it all together. And have me come back so that we can work on that.
Many victims of violence are further victimized by the criminal justice system. Tell us about the perpetrator of your son's murder and about your day in court.
My day in court, the judge was very nonchalant, didn't seem to care. This was just another case taking up his time and his space. I wondered, sitting in that courtroom, like, how did he get on the bench? You know, and maybe we just go and vote people in just because their name is on the ballot. Well, first thing I did after starting the organization, the first thing, started a court watching committee. And we started watching the judges and how they were handling these different cases. But the boy that shot my sons he was 18 years old. He was senior in high school. And a couple of years before, he had accidentally shot and killed his little brother. And the defense attorney said that he got no intervention during that time. So after he got out of prison for killing my son, within 6 months, he had tried to kill someone else. And in that particular case, he was the shooter. He shot a man 3 times, and it was a professional hit. So by then, he was a professional killer. And he had been paid to kill somebody, but he got caught. He and his cousin did this together. There was a police chase. His cousin was killed, and his neck was broken. But he went back to prison, and he's still in prison.
Several people ask a version of this question. Where do you find the fortitude and strength to do what you do, given your loss? And as a parent and mother, I commend you for your work and strength.
Why, thank you. For far too long, I refused to burn out because I said the issue is too important. We had office in the homicide section of Detroit Police Department, office in the prosecutor's office, working with the families as they go to court. And when my sons were shot, we had 653 homicides that year. And even though homicides are down a little, you know, it's still just overwhelming. So you can burn out dealing with one family's cases and problems because there are layers of problems. And in some families, it's not just one homicide. It's one this year, one the next year. And in one particular family, in 10 months, all of this lady's kids got killed. Different incidents. And she's up in age and ended up trying to raise 3 grandkids, you know. So a lot of the families end up, you know, so it's layers of problems. So I committed my life to this, and I wanted to keep doing it. But my oldest son wanted me to take a break. He said I'd probably live longer. So for 2 years, I just kind of went to Nashville to debrief and sat down and couldn't get up. So I've been working on developing curricula around parenting and, you know, still working with the issues, but in a different way. And right now I'm working with the Black Funeral Directors developing a package for them to give to families that have homicide. So I'm still working with the issues. I just finally admitted the fact that I get tired.
Has SOSAD worked with the entertainment, especially the video game industry, where violence is rewarded and part of winning the game?
We have not. It's a need, but the problems are so pervasive. It isn't that we don't acknowledge it as a problem. It's just that we have to kind of choose our battles, and the dealing with families and doing crisis intervention work and teaching peace and doing violence prevention more on an interpersonal level has been the piece that we kind of carved out to do. And we encourage, you know, others that might take on a bits and pieces of this problem to address some of those larger issues as well. And you know, that's one of the things that we might be able to develop with some of the departments that are eager to do something. Yeah.
What kind of gun control laws existed in Michigan at the time? Has the Michigan legislature done anything to make laws tighter? And what can communities do to keep guns out of children's hands?
Oh, God. We debated with the NRA so many times over the years. And they used to say, those crying women out of Detroit, you know, little did they know that what they gave us was a tribute. It is an emotional thing to have a child killed. And we encourage people to cry. We don't wish that on anybody, not even them. And we never really just could come together on this issue. Our position is for peace, and that would mean nobody using a gun. But, you know, you had people that were hunters, and their position is altogether different because they're using the guns for hunting and not for killing a person. But in inner city, there's nothing for you to hunt, you know, but another person. So our laws in Michigan are not tighter. Michigan has home rule. Michigan still has home rule, right? Well, I guess neither one of us are right there right now. But each community could decide for themselves how they wanted to do that. And laws are not tighter. It's been a constant battle over the years. But we not only worked with Michigan laws regarding gun control, we work with that issue nationally as well. And we held anti-gun vigils for 20 years outside of the Spirit of Detroit statue. People from all over the world, when they visited the Canada, Michigan, Ohio area, they would come to hold vigil with us.
A number of people asked about the root causes of violence, and I'll read this particular one. To get at the root cause, don't we as a culture have to legitimize discipline and respect in the home and school again?
I agree with that. See, I told you about my mother's form of discipline being love, you know, having that switch in her hand. As discipline, it's like visibly you can see that she meant business. And we need that. You know, in Tennessee, teachers can still whip kids with the parents' permission. They can still do that in the school. And when I came up in school, you know, we got that discipline in school. And we learned to recognize that as discipline, not as corporal punishment, and there was a difference between punishment and just discipline. But in my book on parenting, it all starts in the home. It really does. How people choose to raise their children, discipline their children, it all starts in the home. And whether or not children are given proper discipline.
Speaking of that, this next question is, you mentioned the strong sense of responsibility that was instilled in you by your family. How can the sense of responsibility be instilled in the fractured families of today, especially when more and more children are being born out of wedlock?
Well, I don't want to even imply that being born out of wedlock is the problem. It could be a problem, but it's not the problem. Poverty is probably the biggest problem that we have, but now we have so many people, using drugs. I started to say on dope. my dad, that's how he used to say it. These people are on dope. He couldn't even say it. He couldn't even say dope. He called it dope. These people are on dope, and they are. You know, it's. People are having a hard time dealing with issues, and so many generations of people are traumatized by bad things happening, by not just poverty, but having loved ones killed and grief and unresolved trauma and economic problems is oftentimes generational. It defines how people parent and how people live, and it's just a growing problem that we're only going to arrest by us working together to try to solve problems.
And speaking of working together, how can we move beyond your mission to bring peace between the races in our country? Have you seen any progress in this area?
Of course, I've seen progress. Barack Obama. So there is progress, because this is the first serious candidate, the first serious black candidate. Well, all of them were serious, but this one has the potential for actually becoming president of the United States. Although I know that racism is very much alive in America, and people don't do a lot to hide it. So, I fear for him, but I do know that people think differently now. It's very narrow-minded of people to think in terms of black and white when we really need to be thinking in terms of survival as human beings. And think of each other as human beings and not just as the color of our skin.
How and at what level could governments help with your programs?
Funding. Seriously, funding has diminished for the nonprofit world. They never gave great funding to start with, but after 9/11, funding cycles changed. And now with what's going on with the war and so much money being siphoned off to go to other parts of the world, there is less and less funding for nonprofits, and especially for working with things like violence. But funding is what they could do.
According to official statistics, there were 404 murders in Detroit last year, and that number has been holding steady for the past 7 years. It's the highest homicide rate in the country and many times higher than New York City's, which has a population 8 times larger. What is it about Detroit?
The economy. The economy in Detroit is really, really bad, and it's worse than you hear about on the news. And maybe you hear it and don't really hear it because, Detroit right now is an 83% black population. And, a lot of people have the assumption that people don't want to work and people don't want to do anything, and that's just not true. But I thought about some of our young men out in the community. One of the young men was killed at an eatery, and his friends planned to burn the place down. But they came to me, and they told me they were going to burn it down. And I asked what else they could come up with. Well, they decided, well, we could shut it down. And they marched. These are young men that were in the street, and they marched. I thought about Abe and all those guys when the Brothers Y organization, when you mentioned the word transformation, because that was just the best example of transformation that I'd ever seen, because these were drug dealers and drug users and the guys that were out all night and slept all morning. And they got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to shut down the business at this local eatery. And the way, that's one of the ways that they transformed themselves. They started looking for jobs and trying to do positive things, and they had the whole community behind them. And there was a little black-owned restaurant about four blocks down that was going to close. And they offered these young men their place for a meeting place to plan their strategies. They went in there and cleaned those ladies' place up, painted it, started eating there. And right now, this happened about 10 years ago, right now, that is the biggest eating breakfast spot on the west side of Detroit. And it's all because they opted. They came to me first, because I knew some of them. They came to me first, and I asked them to try to come up with what else they could do. They decided what else they could do that was positive. And we gave them training. Grace and Jimmy Boggs taught them movement building for 3 days. And they got out there, and they transformed themselves and that community. And help those two ladies make some money.
I do have one final question, yes. But I want to join you at the podium.
Oh, please.
But first, I'd like to ask this group to please join me in thanking Clementine Barfield for the important work that she does and for taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Thank you so much. And we do want to send her with two tokens of our appreciation as ways to remember your visit to Penn State.
Thank you.
And I do have this one final question for you. The New York Times recently came under fire for its questionable sex scandal story involving Senator John McCain. I'm wondering, should we also question the New York Times judgment for its December travel section story that named Detroit, quote, one of the must-see destinations in the world for 2008?
Well, there are a lot of positive things about Detroit. Detroit General Motors World Headquarters is there. I'm from there. Earl is from there. Danny Thomas is from there, and he went on to start St. Jude, which is St. Jude raises over $500 million a year to research childhood diseases. So Detroit is a great place to be from. But no, seriously, there are a lot of positive points to Detroit, and I guess the best thing about Detroit is the people, because despite what all the bad things that happen in Detroit and having one of the highest homicide rates in the nation, Detroit is bent on survival. And there are a lot of things going on right now with the leadership, and they're still hanging in there. And people that are from Detroit love that place. And nobody want it to transform any more than we do. And we're all going to stay committed to it until that happens, because Detroit was probably the first big city to fall. I remember some years ago there was a reporter, T.Y. Chang, that said that, and people were just mad about it. But it was true. It was the first big city to fall, and the hope is that it can rebuild like it did in 1902 when it almost burned down, 1802. See, here I go again. It's like old days, isn't it? 1802, when Detroit almost all of Detroit burned down and it was rebuilt. They rebuilt using the theme, like a phoenix shall rise from the ashes. And I just believe that Detroit will do that again. And even though New York Times might have been making fun.
They weren't making fun.
There are a lot of good positive things to Detroit. There is still hope despite all of the violence and all of the death and all the bad things that's happening. People still live there every day and try to survive. And I'm just darn proud of them. Thank you.
This is so good here. I should say that my sister lives in Detroit and my parents lived in Detroit, so I meant no disrespect. And on behalf of the Penn State Faculty Staff Club, enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you.